There has never been a better time to be alive. And at the same time, there's never been a harder time to be optimistic. And that's because, in my view, we're just bombarded with so much negativity. And frankly, we let a lot of it in. A lot of it's our fault. You know, we can blame social media, but we're in charge. We can decide how much we want to interact with it. We can decide who we follow, who we don't follow, just turn the phone off. And so I think it's a real paradox, again, that this is a great time to be alive, but it's harder and harder to realize that.
Hello, and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Linda Ulrich. I'm also the founder of a gigantic positive news website called The Goodness Exchange, where we've been writing articles about and interviewing folks all over the world who are making the world a better place. And today we have an amazing guest who is doing just exactly that. Bill Burke is the founder of something called the Optimism Institute in 2022. And he brings to this amazing endeavor, an amazing media career that I'm just going to mention a few highlights from because the highlights are almost too big to mention. Bill served as the CEO of the Weather Channel. He was the founding general manager of Turner Classic Movies. And after that, he became the president of the TBS. Bill's a writer. He co-authored Ted Turner's New York Times bestselling autobiography, Call Me Ted. So you can only imagine the expansiveness of the way Bill thinks about the world, possibility, opportunities, and he has a life story that will bring all that to light as well. I was delighted to receive an introduction to Bill recently, and after a deep dive in his digital footprint, I knew that we had to meet. Bill Burke, welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast.
Thanks, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for the kind introduction.
Well, I'm telling you, we can't have enough of people who are talking about what's right with the world. This is it. I never want to diminish in my work all the things that need attention. The world's to-do list is so huge and so important. But I got into this when I realized in 2013 that there just wasn't anybody talking about all the doers, the helpers, the folks like you who just see something that needs doing and launch in. So, you know, start with us a little bit about what you saw as the reason why you needed to start advocating for optimism.
Well, I think it's very similar to the path you were on, where I just realized that there wasn't a lot of positivity out there in the world. And I have children who are in their late 20s now. And been especially concerned seeing younger people really struggle with a sense of doom, a sense of the world's going to end because of climate change, of the distress about, all understandable distress about political divisions, and really wanted to step back and say, you know what, there's an argument to be made that there's never been a better time to be alive than today. And I'm a history buff, and if you study history, you'll realize that that is probably true. And so that's what set me off on this path. And I'll share with everyone a line. I interviewed a gentleman named Kevin Kelly, and he said, if you only read the news, you'll think that things have never been worse. But if you read history, you'll realize things have never been better. And to me, that sums up a lot of what I'm trying to do.
That is such an important point, and I don't want to rush through it. I mean, there is so much evidence that the world is actually quite better every decade. That's absolutely remarkable how much better it is. But Steven Pinker has some great insights about why it doesn't feel that way.
Right. Right. And I've been toying around with this idea of describing it as the paradox of modern optimism, which is that there has never been a better time to be alive. And at the same time, there's never been a harder time to be optimistic. And that's because, in my view, we're just bombarded with so much negativity. And frankly, we let a lot of it in. A lot of it's our fault. You know, we can blame social media, but we're in charge. We can decide how much we want to interact with it. We can decide who we follow, who we don't follow, just turn the phone off. And so I think it's a real paradox, again, that this is a great time to be alive, but it's harder and harder to realize that.
That is such a great point. How about your definition of optimism? That's one of the very first questions I wanted to ask you because,
yes.
You know, there's, I'm sure you've run into it since you've launched into it, but there was a few years back in 2017, 18, where people would actually interview me. And one of the very first questions they would ask was, talk to us about toxic optimism
yes.
or toxic positivity.
Yes.
And I would be like,
yes.
And then we'd get in this debate about the definition of optimism or happiness or positivity. Talk to me first, because you have this down.
Well, I'm getting there. And to me, the important distinction I try to make is that optimism, in my definition, is an active place to be. It's not, I'm just going to sit here and the world is inevitably going to get better. I have to play a part in that. I have to get up and be involved. We all have to. The reason the world is getting better is because people keep at it. They keep working. They keep protesting. They keep researching. It doesn't just happen. So that's a big difference. I bristle at when people say, is the glass half full or half empty? That just defines optimism. It doesn't for me. To me, that's some measure of positivity. To me, an optimist is someone who enjoys the glass and then refills it, right, to the brim. So that's how I define optimism. Toxic optimism or toxic positivity, I've seen described, and I get it, in that that's more, I think, someone says, oh, I'm having a really tough time. You know, someone just passed away, or this awful thing happened. And people say, oh, it's not so bad. Or, oh, you know, you have to honor people's struggles and their tough times. I think that's when the positivity can be toxic. But in terms of keeping your eyes and ears open to all the great things going on in the world, I don't think there's any way for that to be toxic.
Yeah. And the other thing that, like you said, the response that somebody has that feels like head in the sand is, it's all good. You know, you have a complaint and then you go, but it's all good. It's not all good.
No. And that's the other thing too, because sometimes I think optimists can be sort of set aside as naive or, you know, just childish. I will acknowledge that the world is really tough. It's always been really tough. It always will be really tough. But it's a better life to get through when you try to look out for and accentuate the positives that are out there and contribute to them at the same time.
That brings me to a quote that you said, a little short thing. Okay. And I'm not sure I'm not going to have to say that to myself periodically. You said to this glass half full, half empty thing, you said, glass half empty, get up and fill it.
Yeah. I mean, truly, I've had other people say, you know, it's 100% full. It's just half water, half air. To me, that trivializes optimism when people say, is the glass half full or half empty? I just got sort of set that one aside.
Yeah. And I think there's so much science that you and I both know of, or else we wouldn't be committed to this, trying to help a narrative go through the zeitgeist in a better way. There's a lot of science on the fact that optimism has all these physical mental health benefits, these things, and that it's simply a lot of times, or at least maybe all the time, a choice.
Oh, I believe that 100%. So the data on the health benefits are staggering. I mean, even things like longevity, optimists live 15 to 30% longer than people with a more negative outlook. I don't know how they do that research, and I don't know if you live longer, so you're more optimistic, but there's credible science behind that. And in terms of it being a choice, I am more and more convinced of that. And an analogy I use is when you're in the market to buy something, let's say a car, all you notice are cars. You know, you walk down the street and you're looking at every car and you're like, well, I'd never noticed that one before. It's the same thing with good news and positivity. If you walk down the street looking for goodness and kindness and someone drops the shopping bag in the middle of the road and five people go to help them, you'll see it. And the other cool thing today, a positive of social media, is if you're in the market for a car, before you know it, there are car ads in your Instagram feed. The same thing happens when you start sharing, liking positivity on the internet. Your feed improves. Just as the algorithms will spin you down into doom, they will also spin you up into goodness if you choose that. And I've seen it happen. I made a conscious effort when I started this project to try that. And I'm telling you, I have a much more blissful set of social media feeds than I did before. It's like anything else. It's going to give you what you reward. And if you reward all the negativity and doom, you'll get that. And if you do the opposite, you'll get the opposite.
Absolutely. I can't make that point stronger to people.
Yeah.
The world that everyone else sees and describes to me is just not what I see. I've been so almost maniacal about not clicking on anything that I don't want more of.
right,
for a decade that my algorithms don't even hardly know what to meet me except positivity. I once was looking for something and clicked on a Best Buy ad, and I don't click on ads either for that very reason. Every screen from then on for months was blue and yellow with
right.
And every ad, even though they were placed by different companies, was because I gave it one little shred to go on. And I want to impress people that if you have a friend, I have a friend who once said, I don't know what people are complaining about. She says, all I ever see are things about Britney Spaniels and cooking, because that's all I ever click on. And she was saying it in the sweetest of almost naive way. But it is true. If that's all she clicks on is Britney Spaniels and cooking, that's all you're going to get is food and dogs.
Yep. Garbage
and
in, garbage out.
And the same is true, right?
Yeah. And it's the books you read, and it's the TV shows you watch, and it's the people you hang out with. And those are all choices is the way I would describe it.
So I have a TED talk we'll put in a TEDx talk that we'll put in the show notes for people. But that is one of my big points at the end. I talk about this conspiracy of goodness phrase that I'm championing. And in the end, I try and really lay it on people that your click is a vote.
Totally.
It just is. It's the vote for what you will get more of. And it's the vote for what all of us will get more of. Because if you click on negativity, anything that we don't all need more of, then content creators are just going to keep creating.
Exactly. It's on us. The tennis analogy I use is it's an unforced error that we make that, you know, when we're asking for it. And I get frustrated with the way some of these social media companies are run. And I don't think they've always been as responsible as they could be, but still the content is on us. They're serving us what we ask for. And we need to ask for something different. I interviewed recently Chris Anderson, and he wrote a book I recommend to everyone listening. It's called Infectious Generosity. And Chris, for 20 plus years, has been in charge of TED that you mentioned. And he is on a quest, as he says, to reclaim the internet. And he said, I started out in the internet with so many high ideals, and I don't think it's time to give up yet. And his thing is, let's make generosity infectious, and let's let generosity go viral on the internet. And so he is on a quest. He's on a massive book tour right now. And it's a fantastic book. It has a lot of very, you know, tangible recommendations about how we could help with that. And I'm all in. I think he's really onto something. And with his background at TED, and what I would argue that TED Talks have made a huge positive impact on the world. And he's now committed to try to do that in an even bigger way.
Yeah. Okay. So I bet you have a few that are your favorite.
Yes.
Okay. So what we're going to promise people, people may have seen me writing, and I've got a pen in hand. I'm taking notes as we go through this interview for the article that will be accompanying this interview on the Goodness Exchange.
Yes.
You won't be able to get it on Spotify or Apple or wherever else. But if you go to listen or watch this, because it's going to be both audio and video, at the Goodness Exchange, you're going to find a list of Bill and my favorite TED Talks that relate to this. And we'll make sure also we put in all the books that you and I are going to mention. Because I could tell yesterday in our pre-call, we will be giving people something to do next.
You know, I on that note on books, I've always loved to read. But I really, it's funny, as I started to do interviews, and I just did my 50th of this week. So it's added up. And, you know, you start seeing commonalities, and some you'd expect. But one that surprised me, and it's been very consistent, is almost everyone I interview, at some point it comes out that they are a serious lifelong learner, that they keep reading, they keep trying to learn. And I just thought I was trying to make the connection. And my most recent guest, Kelly Corrigan, she said that's just an optimistic position to take, that there's always more to learn, that there's always someone to learn from, that everybody's got a story. And when I interviewed, you mentioned Steven Pinker, I was lucky enough to get to spend some time with him in a program I was doing. And he's a scientist. And he said, one of the reasons we need to keep learning and keep open dialogue is that in science, most of what we believe today is going to be proven to be wrong. That's the nature of science. And so if we close down conversation, if we stop learning, stop reading, stop researching, we're not going to progress. And so I encourage people to keep learning, keep reading, don't get stuck, because, I mean, you think about social issues today that are sort of commonly accepted that 20 years ago just weren't. there's constant progress. So I just always encourage people to keep reading. When someone recommends a book, check it out. That's my spiel.
Yeah, and there is so much. I'll make a place for some of our favorite TED Talks, and for that matter, we'll be giving people all kinds of links to books. I'm reading a book right now called Humankind.
Yes, Rutger Bregman.
My gosh.
Right? Is that the Rutger Bregman?
Yes, yes. Amazing. It's amazing, Bill.
Yeah, so as I recall, he challenges all these things we take for granted. That's one where he writes about Lord of the Flies, I think. So Lord of the Flies, for those who don't know, I read it in sixth grade or whenever it was assigned. And it's these kids on a deserted island who wind up creating this dystopian society, and they're just like brutal to each other. And he's like, we all took that as sort of scientific fact that that's what would happen. And he's like, there's nothing in science to suggest that. In fact, just the opposite. We're wired to be cooperative. I'm so glad you read that book. I'm a huge fan.
Well, and he takes apart all the studies that I couldn't believe he took apart that study at Stanford in the Stanford basement about the prison inmates and guards. Yeah. That was a complete sham.
Yeah. And it just gets passed along as gospel. That's a fantastic book. By the way, I care so much about this. So my podcast is called Blue Sky, and we have a Blue Sky bookshelf that we just put on our website that is all the books that were written by guests that we've had on the show. And so that's an easy way to, if you want to link to that, they're just various wide range of subjects, but mostly on these general issues. Some are memoirs, you know, all kinds of stuff, but just try to make it easy for people. Cause it's been one of the great pleasures for me is the ability to read these books, some even before they've been released, guest books.
All right. I've got it down. We'll link people to the Blue Sky bookshelf. That's a gracious offer. Thank you. Okay. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about the insights and this amazing speech that you gave for a graduation ceremony.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll take a break. You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, we're back. And during the break, you know, Bill and I were talking even more about this book called Humankind. And I do want to mention that book, if you ever had to take a sociology course in high school or college, you learned all about the studies that this guy just takes apart. Bill, am I right?
Oh, yeah. No, it blew me away. You mentioned the prisoner one, and I'm forgetting the specifics, but I absolutely studied it in college. And you find out that the scientists themselves knew it was bogus. And I can't remember all the details of why they put it out the way they did. But years later, it was proven just totally debunked. And we just bought it. And on Lord of the Flies, the guy's like, it was a work of fiction to start with. And we also bought it. And he's just like, there's no fact that that would happen. In fact, there are examples of actual kids getting shipwrecked who cooperated incredibly and were saved. So it's just bunk.
If you know what we're talking about, these studies that are often referred to in sociology courses, he takes apart the five biggest, I'd have to say.
Yes.
Remember the story of Genevieve, the woman that was, you know, brutally assaulted and left to die? That's all bunk, too. There's just like That's all amazing. Of these references. And then you got to consider the source.
Well, yeah. And just as it is true that most believe that we're hardwired to respond to danger, to be sometimes suspect of people who look different. You know, we were sort of wired that way evolutionarily. But at the same time, we survived and thrived as a species because of cooperation, 100%, by collaborating, by free exchange. Matt Ridley's another person. He wrote The Rational Optimist, and he talks about the value of trade and exchange, and you're good at doing this, and I'm good at doing that. How about we trade our output? And that's how the human species thrived the way it did over all these generations. And that's underreported and not well understood.
And in the book, Humankind, he goes way into these examples of optimism. We've talked a lot about the debunking of the studies, but he tells, well, I'm telling you, every time I just leave it on in the car when I'm driving anywhere, I got 15 minutes. I'm dropping into Humankind.
It's a great book.
Okay, so let's move on to this. Some of the insights in this high school graduation. Was it a high school graduation speech you were asked to?
Yes, it was a great honor. And you know, it's like, it's a funny assignment because I just remember when I was 18 or whatever age they are, that just like, I just want this to be over and go to the party. But I was asked to do it because of the optimism work I had started. So I knew that had to be the focus. So I did the best I could.
Well, you mentioned a couple of great stories. I read the transcript of this talk, and it's magical. You know, you talk to us about this way that you spoke to these young folks about how every generation complains about the mess that the last generation is leaving them, which, of course, would be very easy a complaint and true for this Gen Z that's in high school and college right now. But you have such a great take on that. Tell us.
Thanks. I mean, no doubt. I mean, you're sitting there as an 18-year-old and you're looking at this late 50s gray-haired guy and thinking, oh, this guy's going to preach to us, and he's left us with this burden of climate change and political division. And you know, my point to them was fair point, but welcome to the club. Every generation has been left a mess by the one before. And I just quickly used my dad's side of my family. And I tried to say, this is not because they were exceptional, it's because they were typical. And my grandfather got out of University of Vermont and went to France to fight some of the worst battles of World War I, which is a war that was started by his parents' generation, but fought by his. And then his oldest son, my uncle, left his high school graduation, 18 years old, to fight the tail end of World War II, a war that was started by his dad's generation, but fought by his. And then not many years later, my dad gets out of the University of Vermont and gets shipped off to fight in Korea. And all, you know, product of the Cold War that was started by his dad or grandparents' generation. So, and then you fast forward to today and how fortunate we are. My oldest brother missed the Vietnam draft by 3 years, and there are a lot of problems going on in the world, but that group of high school seniors is not thinking about going off to fight in war necessarily. There may be some who decide to enlist, but it's way more the exception. And so then the other thing I thought of was when I was 18 and I looked it up, when I was sitting in that chair to graduate from high school, we had apartheid, we had the Berlin Wall, we had AIDS rampaging. We didn't even know what it was at that time. We had the height of the Cold War. We were boycotting each other's Olympics. My summer reading book one year was Fate of the Earth, which was about nuclear annihilation. Remember the movie The Day After? I mean, and when it comes, and I, you know, we did not do a great job with climate change, but when I was graduating from high school, the environmental concerns were acid rain and the ozone layer. So I had this list and I thought about it. It's like they've all been addressed. Every issue I just described has been addressed. And back to the definition of optimism, it didn't just happen. It happened because people voted and they marched and they researched and they ran their businesses in a way that, you know, worked towards solving some of these things, and politicians negotiated, and all those things have been fixed. So, you know, class of 2023, you're next in line for takeoff, and, you know, get to work. So that was sort of the message I was trying to give. And I don't know how many of them even listened. I got some nice notes from parents and uncles and that sort of thing. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a real privilege, and I was glad to be able to share that.
The decade, you and I are both a little bit too young to have been conscious of any of this, but the decade that amazes me is the decade that we decided to put a man on the moon.
Oh, yeah.
At right. the same time, the 60s, yeah, you know, we were little, or you may not have even been born, but think about the 60s. There were three, or you can count many more, but three right. major assassinations. There was the largest hurricane ever to hit the United States happened in the 60s. Was Kent State.
Sure.
So you've got just after college kids like I do. How would you like it if you had kids in college during the Kent State thing and they were literally shooting college kids?
Linda, I was born in, I'll just say, in 1966 in Detroit. We lived there during the riots in the late 60s. And, you know, when people say this country's never been more divided, my history, I mean, it's easy to jump to the Civil War, but the late 60s, I mean, the Democratic Convention in 1968, I mean, the world between Vietnam and the hippies and the assassinations and civil rights, it was a cauldron. And
yet we shot for the moon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And yet we did that thing. And then the ozone layer, that's a whole nother thing that's lost to history as well. That we were literally creating a hole that got way bigger than Antarctica before the whole world agreed that we were absolutely driving ourselves over a cliff. Yeah. And then the whole world reined it in. And I'm not sure what the statistics are on that, but it's pretty much closed now. So we can do these hard things together, and we can do them during the worst times.
Exactly. And we tend to, it's understandable, I think, but we tend to not celebrate those things and we take them for granted. And that's one of the things I try to do in the work I'm doing now, is just to remind people of all these benefits. And so back to, you know, we can lament technology and the internet and social media, but here we are. I'm in New York. You're in Northern Vermont. We're talking to each other. This is going to go out on a platform where literally just about anyone in the world can watch it. I don't know how many will. But it's incredible, and we take it for granted, or worse, we just constantly badmouth it. And so we have to, I think, every once in a while stop. And again, back to why this is such a great time to be alive, is appreciating those things.
Yeah. I'm going to remind people of an episode we just did. If you're still not buying our optimism about the next generation, I interviewed two key people at what's called the Do Good Institute on the campus of the University of Maryland.
Nice.
Oh my gosh, Bill. I've got goosebumps just thinking about that interview. The University of Maryland has nurtured this thing called the Do Good Institute that's now like the first stop on the campus tours. And if I were taking a kid on the campus tour, they'd be already signed up after I saw the Do Good Institute. But it's catching on so much. The students are causing a demand in every department for some connection. I mean, mathematics and English, they're all connecting to this Duguid Institute that is about social change. And these young people are driving that. And I happen to know it's catching on other campuses. So I think there's a lot to be said about this Gen Z. And again, we're back to how the media frames Gen Z up in some terrible way, which is...
I'm glad you pointed that out, because just as every generation is left a mess by the one before, every older generation looks down on the younger ones as, you know, whether it's Elvis is dancing too obscenely and these young kids today, get off my lawn kind of thing. And there are so many great young people doing terrific things. And that's one of the reasons I like doing this work too, though, is that there are some, as we know, though, who are so convinced that the world is going to such a bad place, you know, 20 somethings who choose not to have children. There's many good reasons to choose not to have children. But when you're not having children because you think the world's going to end in 30 years because of climate change, then you're at a point of doom where it's like, why bother? Why try to mitigate and work, you know, to mitigate and lessen the impacts of climate change if you think the battle's already over? That's not a place we want to get. And so it's encouraging to hear formal programs like that at a university to keep kids engaged and positive and working at these solutions.
Well, it is the kids driving, they're demanding it, which is the real, the real switch flip. And so anyway, I'll put that, it's episode 157 on the Goodness Exchange. I'll make sure that's in the show notes too. I wanted to ask you about your feelings about this pessimism being the evil twin of cynicism. You said that in that speech. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. I've never thought about it like that. Talk to us about this little concept.
Well, yeah, it's just, you know, pessimism to me, there's negativity, there's cynicism. So and Chris Anderson talks about this with generosity, that we insist on perfect generosity, he says. And so someone gives a gift and then the cynic says, oh, well, they could have done that 10 years ago. Or, oh, why'd they give to that organization? They should have given to that one. Or, oh, they made their money in a way that was exploitive. And, you know, it's, that is just, if you want to just pop the balloon of optimism and positivity, you be cynical. And it's just, to me, it's no way to live. And listen, I'm guilty of some of these things too. I don't want to present myself. If my wife were listening, she'd roll her eyes at some of what I'm saying because I have my moments, but it's just not a great way to live. And frankly, people don't want to be around that. I mean, if you think about, you know, the kind of people you want to spend time with, I always tell people, look, life's too short. And so I think cynicism is right there with pessimism. It's just knocking everything that might be good in a way that can spin you into pessimism. Mm,
mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, there's another point in that talk that I absolutely loved. You talked about a recent interview you did with Charles Kenny.
Yes. Love Charles.
And oh, I love the points that you make in the speech about the way he talks about the greatness. And talk about this, about one more thing about the Gen Z and what's their potential.
I will. Yeah. He knocked me off my seat at the end. It was towards the end of the interview. And he didn't just say what you and I just said, this generation's great. And we always older. He said, this will be the greatest generation in the history of mankind. And even I was sort of like, oh, come on. And then he said, they will be the largest in number. So he believes there's a lot of positives to the growing size of population. That's been an interesting shift in a lot of people's mind. Largest ever. The most socially tolerant ever. He said, he did joke. He's like, minus some of the speech stuff. We got to get better about letting people speak their mind. But most tolerant, largest. They will live the longest lives. They will be the most tech savvy, and they're going to be armed and creating new tools that we can't even imagine. And he said, they're going to change the world in positive ways. And I said that to this group because I think I just shared that with them. This wasn't my idea. It was a wonderful guy who I learned from. And after he said it, I was like, gosh, he's right. And if we could allow ourselves to believe that and spread that idea, boy, if I were 18, I'm like, oh, I'm part of the greatest, you know, and the greatest generation has been assigned to the folks who fought in World War II. And I don't want to belittle that at all because it's a very different thing. But he's just saying this generation has incredible potential to do good things in the world. And I think if they all appreciated that and understood that, and if us older folks sort of got out of their way a little bit and encouraged that, that's a great thing. So yeah, I loved hearing Charles say that. He's written a couple of great books, including one called Getting Better, that talks about how well we're doing, especially in more developing countries around the world, how much foreign aid and internal efforts have really made a difference in other parts of the world that we take for granted.
You know, you made a point in your speech. You mentioned something that I had not really thought about, but this is the most socially tolerant generation.
By a mile. I mean, some of the things we get hung up on, these kids don't even think twice about. No. And it's all just sort of the forward march of progress. And
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I'd love for you and I to talk, since we're right there on that edge, let's talk about fear.
Sure.
I mentioned to you, I sent you yesterday, one of my very favorite TED Talks, I'll put this in the show notes as well, is a TED Talk done by a very famous author, Karen Thompson, who wrote The Age of... Anyway, it was, you know, one of those New York Times bestsellers for 2 years.
Yeah.
She did a talk called What Fear Can Teach Us. And it's not an attractive title. If you go there, you won't see, you know, tens of millions of views because nobody is attracted to that title. However, it is one of the most important TED Talks you'll ever watch because she points out something about us all and the power of the stories we tell ourselves.
Mm.
And I think fear is so much about that. Like fear is the enemy of optimism, right? Like, like you said, you can be crabby sometimes yourself or discouraged, all that stuff. And whenever I am there, it's always about somebody's gotten a hold of me and I've let their fears creep in. You and I mentioned AI. Like the big story on AI is how fearful we need to be of it. But you're saying, yeah, but.
Oh, I think AI could be incredibly positive in our world. Yes, I think Mark Twain had a lot of great quotes and you always have to check because there's about three or four people who get assigned all these quotes and half the time they didn't actually say it. You know, Churchill, Twain, MLK, you have to check. But he said something about, you know, almost 90% of the things I've worried about never happened. You know, so we make up fears. We spend so much time worrying about the worst thing that could happen. And that's not helpful. I think that embracing challenges, embracing loss, embracing grief, all those things are part of life. And finding, some will say, silver linings. A friend of ours who's had a devastating loss recently talks about consolation prizes that come from loss and things that you fear. There are positives that come from all of that if we look for it. So again, let's take AI. There are so many subjects like that you can just sort of throw in the middle of the table and watch how people react. And it's like the internet. It's a tool and it's how we use it. And so if you want to be cynical and negative about it, there's terrible things that are going on the internet. It's causing all kinds of problems. Or contributing to all kinds of problems, but it's also allowing so many wonderful things to happen. And so AI, absolutely, there's things we should keep an eye on, but boy, they are making life easier already. AI is going to contribute to advances in medicine and diagnostics. It already is, that we can't even imagine. Kevin Kelly talked about that in my interview. He is just all in. And he said, of course, we have to keep an eye on and create guardrails and be careful. But we also shouldn't squelch it because incredible things are going to come from it.
And that goes back to the attitudes about that, about climate change, about political division, all those things goes back to that saying that I've really noticed in my own life and maybe you too. You tend to see what you look for.
Totally. Totally. No. So for example, we all can be guilty of this, but if you step outside and it's an unusually warm day, you can enjoy that it's an only unusually warm day, or you could say, oh, it's climate change, and have a terrible day. And we know, and I have a weather background, there's a very big difference between the daily weather and climate change. Climate change is happening. It is real. It is something that we really need to address and be concerned about. But to let it rob you of enjoying the day that's 75 degrees when the average temperature is 60, to me, that's not a very healthy way to live. There are going to be fluctuations of the weather that have nothing to do with climate change. You know, there's even, I like to give this example. One of the reasons we struggle to be positive, I think, is because we've talked about this, there's just so much negativity in our face through media. So when I was at the Weather Channel, it was before everyone had a smartphone. That's how long ago this was. And it's a funny place to work because your ratings go up when the weather's bad, right? So hurricanes are like the ratings go through the roof because there's all this buildup and they have a name and everyone knows someone who lives in Florida. And so they worry about it. Tornadoes would come and go and you never got footage. You get footage of the aftermath. Now you get tons of footage of tornadoes because everyone's got a phone in their pocket. And if you asked 100 Americans, are there more tornadoes today than there were 25 years ago? I think 90 would say yes, and there aren't. There are more videos of tornadoes, but in fact, there's no real sense that I've read that climate change will actually increase the number of tornadoes. It will absolutely make hurricanes stronger than things like that. But we think there are more tornadoes because there's so much footage of tornadoes. And that's, I like to describe that because I think that happens with so many other things in the world. And if I'm looking for tornadoes, I'll find those videos. If I'm looking for beautiful, sunny, calm days, I can find those too. They're just not as interesting to people, so we don't see it as much.
I have to share on this concept of how we affect others. We've brushed against it through almost every question, but I don't think that's unimportant. I think that we all have to know that we truly are all in this together. And if we're the complainer or the cynic or the critic, that is one way of choosing to be in the world. But our impact on others, I mean, think about it. That's how we got through World War II. When everybody went down into the subways in London during the air raids, it was critical. There was nobody welcome down there who was whining.
Right. And just small acts of kindness.
Yeah.
And I talk a lot about this, but I've been doing more and more of it, and it just makes my days better. And I think it helps other people in, service situations. So I shop at a grocery store where it is so crowded and so busy, and people are slamming into each other with their carts and they just want to get out. And these checkout people, it's like they're on an assembly line, and they have name tags. And so I'll just say, "How's the day going, Linda?" And it's like they've been tased in a good way. And, I'm getting there. It's warming up outside. It's a nice day. And all of a sudden, we have this exchange. She feels better. I feel much better. And who knows? She might snap right back to but it's these little things that we could be doing more of. And when I walk around the city and I see people just glued to their phones, to the point of bumping into people, it's just, look around. There's so much to do and see and that's not on that device. So I think these little acts in terms of how we interact with people, and they have ripple effects. So that checkout person was probably in a better mood when the next person came, and maybe somebody else heard that conversation. They start one themselves. It doesn't take much, and it's a little thing, but makes me feel better being that way. And I think it helps other people too.
I'm going to also put in the show notes a great interview that I did with a very important speaker author named Drew Dudley. To your point about the grocery store checkout.
Yeah.
He is one of the best storytellers I've ever heard. He has a very famous old TED talk about lollipop moments. If people just put lollipop moments, you're going to get Drew Dudley's 7-minute TED talk. This whole book, it's called Day One. And he makes this point. You know how when you go to work, your first day, usually everybody's at the top of their game. Everybody's friendly. Everybody's holding the door, showing you where everything is. Like, his whole premise is, what if we lived like it was day one for others all day, every day? And he is not a particularly optimistic guy. There's a whole nother side to Drew that, because I've become friends with him over the years, Canadian fella. So he comes close to Vermont once in a while and stops by. But Drew Dudley's book, Day One, is something I'll put, because, boy, it's all about the scenario you just described.
Yeah.
As our almost responsibility when we've got the time and the peace of mind to bring others up, to elevate others.
Yep. Reminds me, the day one thing reminds me, I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan. I'll just put it out there. For me, his live shows are about as epic and celebratory and wonderful. And you leave there just like, how does he do that? How are they going to do that again tomorrow night? And I read somewhere where, at least years ago, he'd get the band together before the show. And he'd say, let's just pretend this is the last 3.5 hours of your life. And they'd hit the stage. And when you're in the audience, it's like they're acting like this is the last 3.5 hours of their lives. They're having the best time. And it's completely infectious.
I can't go away without talking that we discovered we have children the same age. And I have to tell a story on myself that's not so good. And I'd like for you to comment.
Sure.
I'm a science nerd. I just have been one of those people that reads way deeper in every aspect of science than normal. So I remember driving along with my 12-year-old son in the car. He might have been 13. The day NPR was on the radio and the day they announced the thawing of the permafrost. The scientists had no idea that this was happening with climate change. And of course, that's going to drive methane and CO2 levels so far. And I listened to that. Jens is sitting beside me. And I just unconsciously said, we are so toast. That's the end of it. Like, there's no hope. Right. If the permafrost melts, and I'm telling you what, that kid turned white. Now he's already at age 13, he was 6'4" and 210 pounds. He was a giant of a kid because his dad's that way. And to see, first he turned white, then he flushed and he almost was tearful looking at me.
Yeah.
And I realized in that minute how powerful our interactions, our worldview is to our children and the way they see hope and carrying on and figuring out how to do what you can in any situation. I'm telling you, I bounced back so fast, and this is just even more reason for us to get on it and fight and go down swinging if that's what it takes. And then of course I bounced back and he was like, that's the mom, because I'd already been running the Goodness Exchange for 5 years. And so he'd never, ever heard me go on with that much sense of doom. And boy, parenting wise, we have got to remember that what we have on in the car radio, what we say around the dinner table. Talk to me about why you think that matters.
I think it matters hugely. And, you know, people in our generation will talk a lot, understandably, about the mental health challenges of younger people today. It's a really serious problem. And we're quick to say, oh, it's social media's fault. It's, you know, it's the climate change. It's political division. All those things absolutely contribute. It's also how we behave around kids. If we're reading the newspaper and say, oh, God, that guy, act like you do in the car, we're projecting a lot of this. We're putting it all on the kids and all these external factors, which are valid, but we are absolutely contributing to it. And when you talked about the reaction your son had, I also love history. So your science is my history, probably. And Dwight Eisenhower, general, commanding the folks getting ready to storm the beach of Normandy. And he's walking up and down the ranks knowing that if this goes well, huge percentage of these young men are not going to make it. If it goes well, and the disaster scenarios are even worse. But he's got to look them in the eye and give them a sense of hope and confidence. This is an extreme example. But that's been written about, that he had this way of always looking for the positive and the optimism. That's to get people ready to go to die in war. It's a very extreme example, but it's not that dissimilar. And so those young men, mostly men, were looking at him for inspiration, just as your son in the car was feeding off of your vibe. You're the general driving the car, and he's the young, you know, trooper who's feeding off your energy. And that's something I think we have to be aware of as parents.
I really think it's important. And as coworkers, you know, like you said several minutes ago, nobody wants to go to lunch with that person who can't see, you know, anything, any clarity in.
Oh, and when I ran businesses, I mean, if I sat, you know, with a window, and if I sat in my office, you know, looking like this and throwing the phone and, you know, sulking down the hallways, everyone's like, oh, what's going wrong? We're in big trouble. Instead, and this is why it was hard for my wife, because I would come home to decompress, but I was as positive and upbeat as I could be during the workday, because I knew it's partly the way I'm wired, but I also knew that people were feeding off it, and they'll look to the leader just as kids look to the parents, and your demeanor means a lot.
And did that momentum, that attitude, see, I can't help but connect what you did all those professional years with what you're doing now. It seems like the natural trajectory of someone who knows a lot and has understood a lot about human nature. And you probably know a more balanced version of reality because of all the media exposure you had. Talk to us about Blue Sky, the podcast.
Let's talk about the podcast. Yeah. So when I started this Optimism Institute, one of the reasons was that back to technology, it's given us this ability to produce these things called podcasts and reach a lot of people. And so what I wanted to do was not, you and I have talked about, there's a lot of sort of good news sites out there that are, I would say, you know, the reunions at the airport or the rescues of the cat out of the tree and those sorts of things. And those are wonderful. And I'm not putting those down. But what the niche I was trying to fill was talking about these big, gnarly, difficult issues that have us struggling to be optimistic and talking to people who are working on solutions, who have an infectious sense of hope and optimism. I named it Blue Sky after the meditation prompt that there's always blue sky above, but sometimes you have to get your head above the clouds to see it. And I think that's a helpful way to go through life. There's always going to be clouds. There's always going to be storms. So that's where the name came from. And I'm well behind you, but I just did my 50th episode. We started a year ago, so we've been doing them weekly. And it's just been really fun. I mean, I've back to, you know, you looking for goodness, you know, to feed a weekly podcast, you've got to keep looking for people who can have the time, who have the inclination, who aren't going to say no. I haven't had too many no's, but I've had some. And some of the feedback I get is my listeners will say, gosh, where are you finding these people? I've never heard of that person. They were so inspiring. It's like, because I'm looking for them and they're out there. And, you know, someone said to me that, you know, I don't want to say this in a male way, but the good guys have always outnumbered the bad guys, always have, always will. And I would add women to that in definition of guys. And that's just true. So that's Blue Sky. It's been a ton of fun. I now have a Blue Sky newsletter every month. I started this Blue Sky bookshelf, as I said, because a lot of the folks I've had on have written books. Just trying to spread these stories of positivity and give people hope about things like climate change, about political division, about homelessness. I had a wonderful episode where the young man has written a book about homelessness. So all these things that make it hard for us to be optimistic, back to this paradox of modern optimism, trying to address those, knock some of those things down and give people ideas of ways they might be more optimistic and ways they might actually help in some of these challenges.
So I highly recommend the podcast. It's my new, you've beat On Being and Hidden Brain.
Oh goodness. That's elite. Know. That is elite.
That is elite. I'll put those in the show notes too. Gosh, these show notes.
Watch out.
We are going to give people a show notes section that they can change their life. And I don't think I'm kidding about that.
Oh, thank you.
So just for some people know, Hidden Brain is an NPR podcast about how we're wired between our ears. And yes, you will never stumble upon a more accessible, useful podcast because this guy's a neuroscientist and he talks to incredible people all over the world who can tell us exactly how we're wired so that we understand each other and ourselves much better. And a great storytelling podcast. And then On Being, well, I don't even know how to describe On Being.
Yeah, she's special.
Yeah, that's special. Okay, so here's one of the topics we cannot end this interview without talking about. Back to your high school graduation talk that you gave. You talked about, this is such a fresh example of how our minds work, to feed off the Hidden Brain reference. You talked about somebody, a poet or a writer named David von Drehl, I think maybe.
Yes.
I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Yes.
But tell us the cardinal story.
Oh,
because
man.
Because this is what happens to me almost every day, some version of this. And I'm pretty sure it happens to everyone.
Yeah. And this guy writes like butter. I mean, so I won't do it justice, but he wrote this column, I think it was in the Washington Post. And he said, he's looking out the window and he sees this beautiful cardinal, this beautiful bird in the tree. And his first reaction was this feeling of this thing he just read about how what we're doing to the environment is endangering birds. And it turns into this incredibly negative thing. Not unlike, by the way, stepping out on a warm day and then getting anxious about climate change. And he said, I thought about it and I said, am I going to let those concerns ruin my joy of seeing this beautiful bird? And he said, no, I'm not going to let that happen. And then he makes the point that how can we work on the environment to take care of these things that we care about if we don't care about them? If we don't love birds, why would we go work to save birds? We have to continue to love what's good in the world, to have incentive to accentuate those things, preserve those things, make them even better. So he used this cardinal example. And like I said, he writes so beautifully. I'm not doing it justice. It's David Von Drehle. It's Drehle. We'll probably put that in the notes too. It's just this beautiful piece. And I shamelessly lifted it and read it verbatim to these kids because I couldn't do it justice. But that's the idea. So when you see something of beauty, not letting these other things crowd in and make you feel negative, but instead embrace that and say, this is something worth preserving, fighting for. And that's what he did in this example of the cardinal, which I loved.
Do you happen to have that you could read to that little section? I have it in front of me. I can read it if you do. Because it's about the small joys. Like, we can't let the big picture crush our small joys. All day long, small joys are happening right in front of us. But we may not see them if the only thing we can see is the stony path.
I have it. Yes, and I'll start by something else he said. So now I'm quoting this beautiful writer. Joy is becoming countercultural. In fashion instead is a heavy coat of doom. Anxiety and depression are endemic, psychologists tell us. And why wouldn't they be when optimism and cheerfulness are taken as signs of obtuseness, when happiness is a dead giveaway that someone either doesn't know or doesn't care how very bad things are. And so now he talks about the cardinal. Here's where that cardinal finally lands. One cannot usefully address a threat to birds if they do not delight in individual birds. One cannot meaningfully answer the climate crisis if they lack excitement about the human capacity for invention and reinvention. One cannot make progress towards equality and inclusion if they don't see and love the potential of humankind, enemies included. And one cannot build the future if one fears the future. Not bad. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I had to share that with the 18-year-olds. I hope they were listening. But yeah, that's just a beautiful piece. And he captures a lot there, a lot of what we've talked about.
Okay, two more things I want to hit before we wrap up. We can't move on without talking about Steven Pinker. He says, I'm just looking at the data.
Yeah.
He's optimistic about the future. Yeah. He says, and he doesn't seem like a very emotional guy, actually.
He actually was kind of annoyed with me because I used the word, I said in the title of our show, I said something about his optimistic take. He's like, I'm not really an he sees optimism as a state of mind, as a sort of a personality trait. And that is probably the purest definition. He's like, I'm not by nature an optimist, but if you show me the data and it's positive and it shows unequivocally that the world's getting better, I'm a scientist. I'm going to buy it, and I buy it. So yes, your read on him is accurate.
So there's this thing that I have found myself reminding people of constantly, and I'm sure since you have a background in media, you could speak even broader to this, but you know, the headlines are simply about the worst things or the worst behaved people of the day.
Sure.
That's it's not newsworthy if it happens all the time. So the mere fact that it makes the news.
No one reports on the hundreds or thousands of planes that landed successfully yesterday, but they'll report on the plane crash. As Steven Pinker, you just reminded me, he challenged me, or he has this idea. So, you know, when you watch the news, it started around 9/11 where they run they call it a ticker, and it's just giving all this news data. And again, it's like, you know, 8 killed in a terrorist bombing. And he's like, it would really be fun to do, 10,000 people moved out of poverty last week. 933 planes landed safely since this newscast started, just run these positive things, fewer kids died of malaria in the last month than did in the last, it's an interesting take on it. Yes, it is a frustrating thing about the news, but there's some evidence that that may swing back, that there are actually people avoiding the news now because they've had enough and the news organizations are responding. Back to your point about your clicks or votes. If people start withdrawing from that, they have a business incentive to tell more good news. And you're seeing more of it, I think.
Yeah, I do think that. So, I have another 10 questions. So maybe we're going to have to interview Bill a second time. I didn't get to talk to him about so many things.
Sequel.
Yes. Okay. And we don't do that very often on the Conspiracy Goodness podcast, but I think it's almost a guarantee. So I'm going to leave those aside and wrap up with, what do you really wish people knew? I mean, my life experience has led me to this, your click is a vote thing. I've decided if somebody only gave me 2 minutes to say something and then it was all over and that's all I got. I just want to, I think that that can make the most difference. If we hover over everything we're going to click on and we go, no, you know, we could change the future if we just treated our clicks like a vote.
Yes.
So talk to me about what you think you really wish people knew. What has life taught you this whole adventure?
Yeah, it's of a piece, I think, what you just said. It's that our outlook and our and optimism versus pessimism is a choice. And it is the outlook is a total of the many choices we make over the course of a day, week, life. So again, if you choose to get on negative websites and follow people that are going to make you feel worse about the world, you're going to wind up feeling worse about the world. You make that choice. If you walk down the street glued to your phone reading negative news alert, it's going to make you feel a certain way. If you put that phone in your pocket and look around for goodness and say hi to people and pet some dogs, you're going to have a different outlook. It is a choice. I've spent a lot of time on, you know, are optimists born or made and all that stuff. And no doubt some people are wired a little bit more positive or a little more negative or whatever. And obviously there are, you know, situations people grow up in that are so much more challenging. I'm a very privileged person. So I'm very self-conscious about saying some of these things, but I do think that no matter what the circumstances you've been handed, there are choices that are made in your life that will lead you towards different outlooks on life. And I encourage people to think long and hard about that and try to make changes to improve their outlook. They'll feel better. They might live longer according to the data. They'll make other people feel better and there'll be ripple effects. And it's like Chris Anderson says about infectious generosity, can really, you know, we can reclaim the internet and we can reclaim our sense of well-being and optimism for the future.
All right. Oh, that is such a lovely way to wrap up. So Bill, make sure we're going to have all the connections people need in the article on the Goodness Exchange, all the things we talked about and more. But what should people do next? If you really had to say, go do this next.
Listen to Blue Sky. I mean, come on. Okay. We've got 50 episodes. I can't imagine everyone's listened to all of them. And and again, just think about those choices you're going to make the rest of today and going forward about how you want to live your life and influence your own outlook.
Lovely. Lovely. And I'll add that if you want to see a better world, there are places like the Goodness Exchange where your sensitivities can be protected. We promised folks no politics for 10 years there at the Goodness Exchange. So you're going to find article after article of people and projects that are making the world a better place there, thousands of them, and interviews with great folks like Bill on our Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. So join us there at the Goodness Exchange. And don't forget to monitor what you give your vote to when you're clicking. And just like Bill started this interview with, what you see on the screens in your life will change.
100%. And Linda, thanks for having me on. And thank you for all the work. You were way ahead of me on this. And so I really appreciate you blazing these trails and for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm going to keep track and we will have another episode because I just quickly glanced over the questions we didn't get to. And there's just too many good ones. And I know people will have a spring in their step after listening to your observations. I hope the connections that Bill and I have brought to you today will help you through your week with a spring in your step, and you'll find all the joy and wonder that we are these days. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Linda.